Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the sixth episode of the Hyper IgM podcast. In today's episode, previous podcast guest and Hyper IgM patient Chris joined us again to give us an update on his journey undergoing gene editing, a first of its kind and potentially revolutionary treatment for Hyper IgM. To hear more about Chris's journey and gene editing, please view or listen to episode 4, linked in the description. Chris was admitted to the NIH this past summer and is now on the road to recovery. He joins us today to share his incredible, groundbreaking medical journey. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the sixth episode of the Hyper IgM podcast. Today is a special episode because I am joined again by Chris. How are you doing today, Chris?
Hey, I am doing well. I know I look a little different than the last time I joined you, but pretty excited about it.
So for the people that didn't watch the previous episode, which you should because it's a great episode, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself, just non-Hyper IgM related, before we get into it.
Yeah, so non-Hyper IgM related, man, got a full-time job. I'm back at work now. Lately, I've been spending a lot of time outside working on a few projects of mine. I've got a car. I've got some property where I've been spending a lot of my time. And really, it's just been nice to be able to help the family out with chores that need to be done around the property. So I'm also a CrossFit coach where, you know, I get to help others. Right now, that's on hold for the moment as we go through the healing process. But that's just a little bit about me outside the whole health and Hyper IgM.
Awesome. It's so great that you're able to help out on the farm. I mean, that's an awesome way to spend your recovery on a farm. That's super cool.
Yeah, it keeps me busy. There's some limitations around it right now, but it's still a nice place to escape to. So,
all right. We could talk about the limitations as we get into the restrictions post treatment a little later. But so before we get into the nitty gritty, for our viewers that don't already know what Hyper IgM syndrome is, Hyper IgM syndrome is a 1 in a million rare disease that causes a person's immune system to not function properly. People with Hyper IgM are unable to make antibodies, which means if they get sick, they will most likely have a hard time fighting off the infection and could get very ill. Hyper IgM patients are also at a high risk of developing cancer. Without a stem cell transplant, life expectancy for a person with Hyper IgM is an average of 30 years old. However, some do live into their 40s or 50s. But, Chris, you were the first patient to undergo gene editing therapy for Hyper IgM. So first and foremost, how are you feeling overall post-treatment?
Yeah, so that word first, it's still a lot to take in. The doctors like to remind me of that almost every time we talk. Definitely grateful for the opportunity or whatever you want to call it. But overall, I'm doing well. The energy's pretty stable. I've got a lot of my weight back, so I'm able to stay a little active. So just still in that recovery phase.
Great. It's great to hear that you're gaining weight back and energy's up. Yep. So, Chris, can you tell us a little bit about what gene editing is before we get down to what you were experiencing in the hospital for your specific treatment plan?
Oh, man, I hope my doctors don't watch this because this gets a little complicated. So first we get gene therapy, and then, you know, there's CRISPR, what we call CRISPR 1.0 or gene editing. And then why Hyper IgM was such a different approach from a gene edit standpoint is the doctors actually had a program, pretty much the virus, the mRNA guide, I believe is what it's called, to do a single base edit on the DNA. So instead of cutting the DNA strand like CRISPR 1.0, we're pretty much working with CRISPR 2.0 here. And they were able to go down the DNA and figure out what base edit was off that was creating the Hyper IgM genetic disorder, and then pretty much flip it and change that letter on the DNA in order to correct the disorder. So I hope I got that right. The doctors try to explain it to me all the time on how there's, you know, we're at like phase 3 of gene editing here. So we shall see what they say to me.
Chris's doctors, if you're watching this, please forgive him.
Yeah.
He didn't mean any offense. Please don't take offense. So that's a great little overview of it. Obviously, it's a very complicated process, and it's the first of its kind. So, you know, you're one of the only ones that can explain it. So you should take pride in that. So take us through the process of this treatment. So when were you admitted, and where were you admitted, and what were the steps leading up to the gene editing?
Yeah, so first and foremost, you know, we had to start at the foundation, which is the stem cells that I currently have. So, you know, that's going there. It's a lot of blood work. It's a lot of visits. I'm going through the process of apheresis. It's like a vampire machine where they actually pull your blood out, spin it, and then throw it back into you. That process in itself, I had to spend close to 4 days on it, about 6 hours each day. That one gets pretty exhausting, but that gives the doctors what they need in order to correct the things that need to be corrected. So first and foremost, that was square one. Step two is getting it approved through the FDA, the regulatory boards, things like that. After that, though, I mean, it was a little over a year when we got everything approved, and I was admitted mid-July, started the process there. Standard protocol for something like this is about 6 weeks for a standard stem cell transplant. So just take out that word gene editing, right? And we have stem cell transplants all the time, same process. A few days of chemo, and then you get your stem cells, and then you recover. The interesting thing with this one was going into it with some history of liver damage I have, the lung damage I have, that definitely came into account. So admitted in July, supposed to be 6 weeks. I didn't get out until the first week of October. So that was the journey. Along that process, though, what also happened is that first week I was there, the FDA came in last minute and approved another gene therapy for me, which what we did is we actually modified my T cells. So this is it's a study going on in Milan right now. And they figured, okay, well, if we can modify his current T cells, and then he goes through chemo and then stem cells, and then we give him modified T cells, it actually gives you a layer of extra protection as you're going through the recovery phase. So I actually got to be part of two treatments. So the gene edited stem cells, and then I'm modifying my T cells and also getting those on a monthly basis. And I will say that the T cells, for the most part, pretty much saved my life through the whole process. So it was a very interesting finding.
Wow, that is incredible. You're two world's firsts. You know, two is better than one, but that's amazing that's amazing that those T cells were able to give you an extra layer of protection. That's incredible. And now you mentioned that you received chemo during this process.
Yes.
Was that do you know if that was a lower dosage of chemo as opposed to stem cell transplant?
Correct. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's what this is all about, right? Is, okay, you know better than anyone, right, that we do have a way to cure hyper-IgM through a normal process of a stem cell transplant from a donor, okay? So that comes when it's from a donor. You've got to go through more chemo, a lot more medications. You're usually on meds for quite a while to combat the graft versus host, things like that. Whereas when we're using my DNA that's corrected, you nailed it. It is a lower dose of chemo. And on top of that, there is no possibility for rejection because it's my DNA. It's my body will recognize it as its own. It just comes down to if it does work or not. So,
for sure. Okay, so it was a lower dosage of chemo as opposed to a stem cell transplant. So that's part of the benefit, I guess you'd say, right, of going through this treatment, is that you can receive a lower toxicity of chemo. So going back to hospital life, like what was going on in the hospital.
Yeah.
So how did you keep yourself occupied during this? Because obviously you did say that you unfortunately did have an extended stay at the hospital. So what were you doing in that hospital bed to keep yourself occupied?
For a while, I was very active. I was walking outside a lot. Of course, I was wearing a mask. I always had someone with me. The NIH campus in Bethesda, Maryland is beautiful. It's large, it's enclosed, a lot of wildlife. So once the energy started running low and walks weren't advised, I spent a lot of time. This probably wasn't the best choice now that I look back at it, but I watched the Great British Baking Show a lot. And, you know, when you're watching there and they're making this stuff and you're sitting there just living on hospital food, it's I was hungry a lot. After that, I'm a sucker for some good old Hallmark holiday movies. And then, of course, just lots of TV shows, lots of video games. I think, you know, every day I was visited by teams of doctors. And when I say teams, I mean three different groups. Each group probably had four or five doctors with them. And I had my gaming laptop set up. I had my normal laptop set up. So it was always fun to talk with the doctors about what I'm doing just because I just had so many screens. But I needed it.
Okay. Well, you know, even though the British baking show might not have been the greatest choice, at least you were occupied.
At the time,
you
know? Yes.
At the time, you know, at least you were occupied. It's all you can ask for. So you mentioned that you had teams of doctors visiting you. Could you have other visitors visit you while you were in the hospital?
Yes. So I was very fortunate that family and friends came together for this, especially with the extended stay. So I had a rotation constantly working of family and friends, pretty much staying a week at a time to keep my mind occupied. So it was nice to be able to have just the different company come and go as they pleased.
Okay, that's great to hear. So was there a risk of having the visitors in the room during your treatment, or were they, like, did you have to wear a mask again? Like, or was it very, like, okay, they can just have visitors?
There was one point where we ran into kind of a risk. That was, I unfortunately got COVID. And point, I got put on isolation, had 20 days of isolation, couldn't leave the room. But visitors were still allowed for the most part. They had to gown up and wear a mask. But outside of that window, there really were no restrictions. Just mainly we masked up whenever we walked around.
Mm. So during that time where you got COVID, did the treatment continue or did it have to be put on pause while you were recovering?
Correct. So we actually had to put that on pause. So that happened before chemo. And then we had to wait about 14 days. And then after that, we actually started the chemo while I was on isolation and recovering. Now, COVID, I got very fortunate. It was probably the mildest case of COVID I've ever had. Okay. But it's just precautions we have to take. I mean, you have to realize that I'm on that floor with other patients who are at risk and completely understood it and respected it. But being in a room for 20 days of not being allowed outside or even to walk the hallways was a little challenging.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Okay, well, at least you were able to have visitors.
Yeah.
That's great. So let's lighten it up a little bit. do you have any funny stories, anything that happened that was nice and surprising or funny while you were at the hospital?
There were a couple. The one that stands out to me most, I had a visitor flying in. Plane got delayed. At that point, I wasn't going through chemo, but I was, you know, under Campath, right? So Campath, that takes your lymphocytes all the way down and knocks out your immune system as well. And I was pretty tired. So it's like 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, and they finally arrive. And I roll over and I wake up because rest is hard to get. And they walk into the room in a full-on clown costume. And this is my visitor. So you heard me earlier say that the NIH is a pretty big campus. So as I'm sitting there trying to recover, my nurses, you know, it's the night nurses at this point, and they're all for it. So I'm thinking that they just changed in the hallway, right? Down in the bathroom or something. Well, I find out that they got off the subway or the metro. They went through security, and then they changed at the security office and then walked 3/4 of a mile in a clown costume across the campus. Yeah, it definitely lightened up my mood that night, because that week was a little challenging for me, so.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah. I remember when I was in the hospital that they had the clowns walking around all the time, in the hallways. They were pretty funny. I remember those guys. Yeah, okay, so clowns in your room at night. I'm sure that wasn't the most, like, settling thing, but funny.
Definitely just waking up to, and but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just waking up and there's a clown standing at the side of your bed. Yeah, that's not scary at all while you're going through one of the most pivotal moments of your life, just, and then you see that. Yeah. So, after you were discharged from the hospital, what restrictions do you have recovering right now?
Yeah, so I still have an 8-to-5 job. It's supposed to be in office. So, restriction number one is absolutely not. No office. Try to limit yourself of people, crowds, and confined spaces. And they stay pretty strict with that. And I'm usually not the best patient, but I have been listening to the doctors and I am happy to oblige because they've just done so much for me. So that is the biggest restriction right now, is just making sure I avoid crowds, making sure I avoid a lot of interactions. And then, of course, when it comes to the property, you know, I've got to be safe around cattle, around livestock, around water. And then we move a lot of hay, so I'm usually wearing a respirator for things like that. And that's just because of the particles in the air, you know. Still, yeah. I'm on limited protection. I really don't have much. I'm still getting my IVIG treatments, but we're still waiting for that immune system to restart.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, when I got out of the hospital, until my immune system was back at 100%, I was, like, gloved up, you know, everywhere I went. And had a mask on, and, you know, I was on the COVID trend before COVID was a thing. I had the mask, and I was all gloved up. So do you wear, like, I know you talked about the respirators, that's like your mask. You wear, like, gloves around the cattle and stuff. And
correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So pretty similar restrictions on the back end of treatment with you and compared to a stem cell transplant.
Yep.
All right. So I know we talked about how your family visited you, came to the hospital with you. What was the reaction of your family and friends to this journey?
Oh, man. You know, we'll start with the family. I'm very close with the family. My mom and dad have been with me, obviously, since day one, and it's been a journey with them through childhood, through all the illnesses that just never stopped coming. So we definitely, you know, even at my age, when you think that you're as close to your parents and you're as close to your family that you think you'll ever be, there's always that room to get closer. And that definitely happened here. You know, just being with them and just watching them make their sacrifices to make sure that they were in my room beside my bed through the whole process. I'm beyond grateful that I've got parents who were there just nonstop, making sure that everything was okay. If I was having a bad day, they were trying to work with everyone to kind of give me rest, things like that. So, and then my friends, you know, the ones that knew really what I was going through, they know that I kind of like my distance from my friends just because I don't want everyone to worry, you know, and my biggest thing is always about people worrying. But they didn't listen to me, and I'm very grateful for that because any day someone would text me or send me a message or write me a card checking up on me, it just lit up my world. So everyone was very supportive and was there with me through the whole process. And I can't be thankful enough for it.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to, you know, people sending gifts and sentiments of gratitude towards your parents, getting closer to your parents with treatment. I know I think that part of the reason why I'm so close with my parents now is because of my days in the hospital and them always being by my side. Like you said, you know, I'm also so grateful that I had parents that made those sacrifices to be with me in my room, you know, even though I was a small child. But still, it's just, you don't think about that aspect of going through treatment, like your family, friends. It's always about like, oh, you know, I am going through the treatment, but it's a journey for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's not just a journey for us.
Yeah. And you don't realize how big of an impact it is for me during the treatment. And then you get through everything and you get out of the hospital and you realize that, man, like they made it possible. Everyone made it possible with everything. I mean, the words, the gifts, just like you said, it's hard to see in the moment. But then when you get to reflect on it, you realize just how blessed and grateful I am because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is an interesting, like, treatment, you know? It's a really, it's an interesting, thing, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
So what stage are you in the recovery? I know you mentioned that you're waiting for your immune system to come back. So that's where you're at for the recovery?
Correct. So we talked about the T cells earlier. So I've actually been going back to the NIH about every 6 weeks right now to receive a T cell infusion. And I went back earlier this month. So at stage in recovery, it's still, hey, Chris, everything's looking good. Just sit tight, hold tight, mask up, glove up, just like you said. And we're in that waiting period of things to be educated for everything to kickstart and start back up.
So is there an expected timeline at all for when you think your immune system will start back up? Or is it because this is the first of its kind, they're just kind of like, we got to wait?
So what I got given earlier this month was about 6 months. So they said 6 months from the day I got my treatment, which was mid-September. So we've got a few months to go, but they also made that disclaimer of, okay, well, on average, it's 6 months when you look at a standard stem cell transplant patient, but you also started with no immune system, and this is new to us, so we really don't know, but we're going to guess around 6 months.
Okay, so 6 months. All right. And I know that when I got out of my stem cell transplant, I had all these different complications, and you know, my immune system, I don't know the exact time frame that my immune system took to come back, but I know it did take me a while. So, you know, I feel like this period is a little anxiety-inducing, maybe. I don't know. I'm not trying to project my feelings on you, but I know it was for my parents and family waiting for my immune system to come back.
So anxiety inducing, that's a great way to put it. To be blunt, yesterday was a pretty tough day for me. And not from a health standpoint, but from a mental standpoint, because just like you said, we're waiting for something to restart. And of course, I can go down these rabbit holes. And yesterday I went down them of, but what happens if it doesn't? So what do I do next? What ifs? If thens? You know, all these different statements. And I try my best to avoid that. And thankfully, I've got the family and friends around me that they can usually pick up when I'm down that rabbit hole. And they pull me out of it pretty quickly. But yesterday was definitely one of those days where I was thinking about it. And it's hard not to, because it's so life-changing, especially when you've been sick your whole life and you've got to go through treatments once a month. And then there's just this glimmer of hope out there of, man, I might not have to do this again and I could be healed. And so the waiting game, to your point, it's tough. But again, family and friends help keep me occupied. And I think that's the best advice I can give to anyone going through that period of waiting, is just stay busy. Do things you enjoy, spend time with family and friends, go outside, be active. So,
yeah, I'm sorry to hear that it's such a hard time for you, especially because this is a moment full of hope and full of fear.
Yep.
But you've made it out of the treatment part, and it's just, it's incredible to just hear your story of resilience that's now completely different than any other hyper-IgM patient's story. You know, the disease is already one in a million, and now you are just a one, you know? But, you know, it's you're the trailblazer. You're really setting the path for other future patients. So we just now talked about the mental side of it.
Yep.
Do you have any regrets so far about undergoing the process? I know it's still early, but any moments where you're like, I shouldn't have done that?
No, definitely no regrets whatsoever. You know, and even going through it, my family asked that, and my friends would ask me, do you regret this? And no, I don't. No matter what, I definitely weigh the odds of things. And the guy said it in our first podcast, which statistics are statistics, and we can only control so much in our lives. But it was something that I felt to my core that needed to be done. And I let the doctors do their job and sat there and prayed. And here we are. And with that being said, just a quick update about going through that process and where we're at now. If you ask the doctors today, did it work? They will tell you that within my blood work, it showed a correction rate of 92% and that everything is well engrafted at this point. So the doctors believe it worked. I believe it worked. We're just, again, waiting for it to restart, which it's all good news. So I just wanted to throw that in there that when they did pull it this month, we did see a correction of 92%, which to them is pretty outstanding. So that's that bit of hope that I needed, but it's still hard at times.
Sure, it is still hard, but 92%, that's, yeah. Then they say it's phenomenal. That is phenomenal then. That's a bit of hope, as you said. So what would you say to someone else who's considering undergoing gene editing at the point of the treatment that you are at now?
I mean, if we look at it as just a standard gene editing stem cell transplant, you know, it's a 6-week protocol based on what the doctor's built out. It sounds heavy. It sounds like a lot to go through, a lot to take on, but going through it, I will tell you, that with the chemo part, with the stem cells, with the CAMPATH, that was the easiest part for me. It was the other health conditions I have that unfortunately reared its ugly head, but that also opened up extra doors for the doctors, and that's where the T cells came in and things like that, that they figured out would work in ways that they had never imagined. So again, just bringing it back to what would I say? I would say that if you get given the option and you weigh the pros and cons of three choices, right? You could do nothing. You can do the standard protocol, which is a stem cell transplant from a donor, right? Or you do the gene editing and it's your DNA. I think when you look at those from a risk versus reward standpoint, you've got to take all that into consideration. But right now on paper with the way that things are looking, undergoing gene editing is a safer route with less long-term side effects. And that's why we went down this road. And to your earlier point, you know, with the age, most of us don't make it into our 30s. Maybe less than a handful of us make it into our 40s. And the numbers get smaller when you get into the 50s, right? And that's why I was able to go through this, because I was at that cusp of a standard stem cell transplant wouldn't work because graft versus host and everything else would have been pretty brutal. So I know that was a lot, but I definitely didn't take it lightly. But I do believe it was the right choice. And I think anyone considering it, if they get given the option, I would definitely consider it.
I really appreciate your feedback with that, because you know, this podcast is for not only people that are curious about hyper-IgM, not only to raise awareness for hyper-IgM, but for other hyper-IgM families that are out there looking for a way out, looking for a treatment, looking for some sort of hope. That's why we're here. And I really think that your story can really help people just feel that little bit better, a little more certain of a better future. So just thank you so much for coming back on and sharing an update on your very impressive journey. So before we wrap up this episode, do you have any final words of wisdom, anything to tell our viewers?
Oh, final words of wisdom. That's always a tough one. I will say, just going through what I've gone through this year, going through all the health scares that I know all of us have gone through, to your point, but also the families and friends have gone through, my biggest thing has always been, you know, life is full of unknowns. It's full of complicated decisions that we have to make every day. Man, at the end of the day, it's about weighing our options and just making sure we spend our energy on the things that we can control. I say that, and you know, I also just told you that yesterday I went down a rabbit hole, so it's not easy. But even during some of the most trying times that we've been through, and that I've been through this past year, I will say it's still possible to find that peace, to find hope when things get a little dark. I think I said in our first podcast, I lean heavily on that power of, you know, the power of my faith, my family, and then my community. And I'll never be able to thank them enough. They helped me through this process. They helped me find peace and hope in their own way. And in this game of life, no matter how tough the hand that we get dealt may seem, whether you have an illness or you don't have an illness, whether it's hyper-IgM or you're a family of hyper-IgM, just never give up. There's always that glimmer of hope, and it's up to you to really chase it. And then back to our family and friends. When those days get dark and you feel like you don't have that energy to chase that hope, to try to chase that peace, and as a patient, I've been there a lot. When you don't have that energy to go after it, I promise that there's someone in your corner that is more than willing to step in and help you go after it. And, you know, you just have to ask. And that's what I'll leave you with, is that we just have to ask. There's always going to be someone there to, you know, step in that ring with us and take on this journey that is out in front of us.
Thank you so much. I mean, you really said it all. I don't think I have anything to add onto that. It was really the perfect ending for our viewers and listeners, everybody who's watching the podcast. Chris, everybody, give him your virtual round of applause.
Thank you.
Yeah, really, again, really appreciate you coming back on. So make sure to like and subscribe for more episodes just like this. And Ezra Feynman and Chris on the Hyper-IgM podcast, signing off. Till next episode.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow or subscribe to our podcast, rate or like this episode, and share. It means a lot. Stay tuned for more.